This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hospitality workwear and hotel and restaurant uniforms. Learn more at tilletnyc.com. Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, cool, wacky, interesting people who have done cool, wacky, interesting things and are now working in food, which is not cool, not wacky, or interesting.
It's just cool, boring
and terrible all the time. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are joined this week by the awesome Alicia Kennedy, who is a freelance food writer and podcast host, an expert in veganism, and her podcast is called Meatless, which we'll talk about a little later, I'm sure. Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And my life is definitely wackier since I got into food.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wackier and better.
Wackier how? And you're also in food in a lot of different ways.
Right.
Cooking it, serving it,
right.
Eating it, baking. Talking about it, writing about it, pouring wine for people.
Right, which I actually just put in my notice. But
oh,
yeah.
Congratulations. All right.
But yeah, no, so because I used to be a copy editor at New York Magazine, which is like the most not wacky job you can possibly have, like enforcing grammar rules and style. Yeah.
Enforcing them on who?
On the writers of New York Magazine.
Were they, how did they
respond?
Yeah.
Sometimes it was bad, sometimes it was good.
So then what was the, how did you, let's talk about this. Why food? How did you make that transition?
Right. So I've always loved food and eating. And when I was in high school, I thought I'd go to culinary school, but then I didn't. I went to school for English instead. And then when I graduated, actually, my first writing job was reviewing restaurants for this website called Geo, I think it's called. It's like a travel website, and they would have little blurbs. So I would review different restaurants on Long Island, where I'm from. And yeah, that was my first foray into writing, was actually writing about restaurants, which I didn't anticipate. But then it came full circle many years later when I was copy editing, became vegan, decided I wanted to bake vegan. Well, didn't actively seek creating a business, but ended up creating a business because I just started baking a lot and had to do something with it. And then, did that. And then that I ended the bakery. My ex and I broke up. That happened. And so that's what happened there. And then I decided I wanted to write about food because I felt like I had a different perspective from having written about it, and also being focused on veganism and like knowing all these like cool little businesses that I thought, you know, should get attention that weren't getting attention. And then, you know, I found out that they weren't getting attention because no one really cares that much. But I've tried to make people care.
So how do you make people care about it?
Oh boy, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you've done a lot of big pieces recently. You wrote a very significant in length and sort of depth and content about Puerto Rico food systems post hurricane.
Yeah.
So you've taken in your writing career have taken a real stance on bringing attention to issues in food that are not being talked about.
Right.
Why is that important to you, or what?
I don't know. I think that's just where my interests lie, and I think I would be so bored if I was, you know, I do write like a lot of neighborhood guides for like Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan, and like if that was my whole life, I would, you know, I would run
out of things.
Exactly. I would be very unhappy. So, it makes me excited to kind of shed light on like basically colonialism and the ways in which that affects the foodways of Puerto Rico, and shine a light on all the people there who are making pushes toward food sovereignty. Like that's been a focus of mine for 4 years. I've been going there and reporting on on chefs and on agriculture there, and also on bars and cocktails there since for 4 years. So yeah, and this one big piece for how we get to next, where I was the food columnist, is was really the kind of culmination of a lot of that work.
How do you get, like, what do you think is the big thing in just pieces in general? How do you get people to care about something that they might be unfamiliar with?
Right.
And also, in the case of Puerto Rico, they're kind of detached from physically.
Right.
But yet, like, we need people to care.
I mean, strong characters, I think. I mean, that storytelling in general, right, is to present people who have a very clear point of view, are all often pretty eccentric, and, you know, are open to talking, really open, honestly, about, you know, the ways in which their work and is impacted by these massive political decisions in which they have no say whatsoever. Yeah. So, yeah, characters, I think, are always, and hopefully the writing's good. Yeah.
So tell us about veganism, how that became a part of your,
right.
personal interest and expertise.
I've always been interested in veganism. Like, I mean, he's persona non grata now and should be forever, but Moby, when I read his the liner notes of a play when I was 13, and it was like my second concert ever, it was very influential to me, and I had this like really strong drive to stop eating meat and like eventually be vegan. But that didn't work because my parents, you know, I have a lot of people on my podcast where they're like, oh, my parents were accepting, or they were just like, oh, just cook your food. And like, for me, it was like, no, like, it was just, you're not going to do that. Like, and I would try, I would get like 2 days before someone would like wave a chicken wing in my face. But,
what was their, like, why weren't they supportive?
They just didn't, I mean, I don't know. I have very young parents who are also like, they worked a lot, and it was like, you know, it was just another thing to put them through. Like, so yeah, it was, and no one took me seriously, which I guess, you know, maybe my whole career is just begging people to take me seriously now, but
aren't we all?
But yeah, so like I always had that drive, I guess. And then like when I was in my mid-20s and I was like, hated being a copy editor, it was so boring, and I was like, started going to yoga a lot, and then like all of a sudden I was vegan, and then I was baking vegan and that sort of thing, and my interest in it has evolved and changed because I became vegan in 2011. I decided to loosen up and be more like kind of 80% vegan, 20% vegetarian in the last couple of years. And yeah, the motivations behind it have changed a lot, where it used to just be like all about ethics and animals, and now it's more about, I want to eat in the way and support the best way to eat for like our ecological, you know, well-being, and for you know, for to support local economies. Like, that's more of how I perceive the way I eat now.
What do you think about for veganism, and also just, I think, the whole eating local, eating better, farm-to-table movement, where many times it is more expensive, or it's very inaccessible. Like, how can we make that system better so that people who would want to be vegan or want to be vegetarian, even 80% of the time, can feel like they can do that?
Right, and I mean, that's the big million-dollar question. Yeah. But I mean, I think for me, focusing on vegetables has been the most important thing, and focusing on what you can do with vegetables and what you can do with like less processed foods. And a lot of the mainstream discussion of veganism is about things like Beyond Burgers and Impossible Burgers, yeah, which I am, you know, a very vocal hater of. But
tell us why you're a very vocal opponent of the Impossible Burger.
Our last podcast guest, or our last guest, Will Horowitz, had a similar stance.
Oh, cool. I need to listen to this then. Yeah, they are. It kind of answers the question I was already answering, which is they kind of encourage all the worst tendencies of our food system, which is, and I mean, this is super evident now because Impossible Burgers are like going into Burger King, and now to keep up with the demand, they have to use GMO soy in the process. And the thing is like, well, we should stop trying to meet the demands of something like Burger King. We should be trying to focus our resources more locally. And then it costs $80 million to create it. And now I just read a piece the other day, like, that people are, you know, there's a multi-billion dollar search to, you know, replace vegan eggs with some vegan product. And it's like, there's flax, there's arrowroot, there's cornstarch. We already have things that do these, and they have agar. We don't need the algae eggs necessarily. I mean, so veganism it connects to these questions of accessibility and how to create a more equitable food system, because it should be thinking about itself as a way of eating that supports vegetables and local farmers and sort that sort of thing.
How do you feel about kelp?
Kelp seems great. I touched some kelp recently. I was at a restaurant. The chef was like, "Oh, I have some kelp that this guy brought me. I'm going to do something with it." Like, and he brought it out, and I touched it, and it felt like plastic. I guess it's harvested in like Connecticut or something.
Okay.
I haven't eaten anything cool with kelp, but I look forward to it.
Yeah, Will has said that kelp is like super sustainable. It's really great, and he thinks it's going to be the next big thing. So I'm like kind of curious.
But I mean, I think the thing is, the next big thing is we have to stop that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
So what should we do instead? What's the?
I mean,
people love getting excited about trendy new foods.
I know, and I guess you benefit from this in ways with.
We import kelp.
Right.
So I'm hoping kelp takes off.
I have some of your kelp,
but yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you that like the emphasis on the next big thing is a little bit misdirected. We should all appreciate the things that are already available and get to know our pantry better rather than try to add more things to it, especially when we're talking about something like an Impossible Burger, which is a highly processed, not very healthy, just sort of a recreation of vegetables that you could eat in their regular form. Right. But instead we have to color them and flavor them and squish them into a patty and make them look like something that they're not. But on the other hand, the interest in trends, I think, speaks to an adventurousness, right? Like a drive to experiment and to taste new ingredients and hopefully to connect with the cuisines and the cultures and the histories behind them.
Right. And I mean, this is where I think I've become kind of a curmudgeonly like aesthetic person around these things, where I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just think that people's, and then this is a very vegan thing to say, I guess, is that like your desire or your preferences aren't the most important thing in the world. Like you know, we might have to suffer a little in terms of like always satisfying our cravings.
It's very anti-capitalist thing you to know say.
I mean,
how could you?
Sorry,
I was I just read a book, Adam Gopnik, who's a food writer for New Yorker primarily, I just read a book of his called The Table Comes First, where he talks about these sort of opposing drives in food and in food trends in particular, that the two ends of the spectrum are purity and newness or uniqueness. And so his theory, whether we agree with it or not, it talks about we swing back and forth, that we're in a pure moment where we want this like true form of the food and farmers markets and like connecting with heirloom varieties of vegetables or meat or whatever it is. And then the new form, which is molecular gastronomy and interesting ingredients and the Impossible Burger, and that there's always this sort of tension between those two impulses. How do you, as a journalist, as someone with a platform and an audience, how do you sort of manage the responsibility that you have or the power that you have to push that debate?
Right. And what's hard for me is that while I'm like this curmudgeonly anti-capitalist aesthetic about what we should desire in food, I love molecular gastronomy. Like I just ate, I went to Mercado Little Spain. Well, I was just there today, but I was also there recently, and I ate like a liquid olive, and I was delighted by it.
It's a liquid olive.
Liquid olive. Yeah, it's like a spherified olive.
Yeah, it's a spherified olive, and it tasted good. It was a cool sensation. I was like, this is fun. It cost $2.25. I don't know, and like $2.25. So like, and it was a fun experience for that much money. But yeah, so I try to balance. I think like. Most explicitly right now, I have this column at Nylon, like a vegan recipe column. So, and I've only done three so far, but I have plans for the rest of them. And trying to balance my second column was about zines, like vegan zines, and the history of them and how influential they've been to vegans and otherwise, around like merging veganism with other political movements and that sort of thing, and identity politics and all that. And then, you know, I'll also write about, a chef who is you know, cooking with their vegetables from their local farm. And then, otherwise I also write about like cocktails. So I'm always kind of dealing with this tension of like, you know, you have to enjoy life, but you also have to be thoughtful about it. I don't know. So
are all vegans miserable and unhappy all the time? Is that?
I don't think so, because most of them are like eating Impossible burgers and like drinking milkshakes and, you know.
The like, new Starbucks milkshake thing with Ariana Grande. That's like actually not vegan.
Oh, really?
that was a whole thing.
I mean, that's the thing too. Like, vegans get very upset if you're like, if you say you're vegan and you do something that seems not completely vegan. But a lot of veganism right now is built around consumerism, and like Instagram is fostering that, and I mean, all food people are, you know, there are people in here who are going to take pictures of their pizza and that'll signify something about them and their life. But in veganism, it's like weird because you're eating a like soft serve cone and you're acting as though that is a good deed that you're doing, like when it's just buying a soft serve ice cream cone, and you don't know what ingredients were used in that, and like even like the best vegan ice cream is made with like cashew milk and coconut milk, and it's like, but you're making it in Brooklyn and those things don't grow here, and like what is the impact of that? And so
almonds are very bad for the
exactly
environment.
Yeah, and it's like I'm eating ice cream all the time, but like at the same time it's like I feel like in veganism there is this like real resistance to asking those kinds of questions.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's already such a you know, you're giving up so much already to be vegan, and then you're like, I've done my part and that's it. And like, if I eat the Impossible burger, I'm like saving the world or whatever. But yeah, because you've already given up so much.
Do you have a working definition? What are there things that, I mean, our guest last week is an oyster farmer, right, and he talked about potentially oysters being considered vegan.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have an oyster tattooed on my arm right now.
Vegan? Like where are your limits? What's your boundary of veganism?
Right. So I feel like I want to redefine veganism to mean, I don't know. I mean, I would like to live in a world where you didn't need to call anything vegan, you know, where it's like we're all doing the least amount of harm naturally. That would be nice. But I eat oysters for my own personal reasons. I come from Long Island. Like, that is, like, oysters are from there. They're from lots of places, but, like, oysters are very important. And honey, usually people are like, is honey okay? And I'm like, sure, because I don't like to be annoying anyway. And so, but also it's like, you know, the bees don't die when you eat honey, but similarly to dairy or, you know, eggs, it's those animals don't die, but you still don't eat their products. So, and I'm sure that there are a lot of vegans who would hate me for eating oysters or eating honey, which is fine.
But if they're being treated well.
Right. And I mean, that's the idea. But like, then it's like, okay, well, if there's chickens being treated well, can't we eat their eggs? And I would say yes. Like, and if there's a farm where, you know, they slaughter animal, you know, they have animals there to serve a purpose and they slaughter them very rarely and then eat the meat, like, you know, that also, am I going to say that that's a bad thing? No.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, in Long Island, I went to an egg and dairy farm, no slaughter at all. And it was like the happiest chickens, the happiest cows. They like run up to you. They want to be pet because you can tell that they've been taken care of. And it was like the best eggs, the best milk that we've ever had. And so it was like this. Yeah, it was like, well, should we be in this? But at the same time, these animals are happy, and we're helping them support their farm. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, no, my thinking on all of this completely changed by just going to more farms and seeing people treat animals in a completely, like, familial way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
And it does seem like veganism is often defined more by what's excluded rather than what's included.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not vegan, and it's not something I know a lot about, but right, like this, I mean, even the way that I just asked you my last question, is honey okay? Are oysters okay? We're already kind of drawing lines rather than building out from a central philosophy.
Yes. And yeah. I would hope to push people more toward building outward and moving more toward a more holistic, sustainable framework rather than just, you know, we don't eat this, we don't do this, that sort of thing.
Why do you, not to put the blame on you for all vegans, but you know, like Bourdain was sort of famously anti-vegetarian or anti-vegan, I think partially because there's this perceived sort of holier than thou judgment that often comes along with it. why do you think that is? And is there a way to change that mentality?
I would hope there is. I mean, I've never been a holier than thou. I'm sure I've had my moments, but but I've never felt like I'm better than someone because I haven't eaten meat or when I haven't eaten dairy or haven't eaten eggs. Like that's certainly not how I have ever felt. And there are people who have felt that way, and they're usually men. But
judgmental,
hardcore vegans. Like we were just talking before the show about, you know, eating insects. And I was saying I had Soleil Ho, San Francisco Chronicle restaurant critic, brilliant writer, on my show to talk about that because she had authored a graphic novel about eating insects. And I had posted a picture from it on my Instagram story and been like, you know, so excited to interview Soleil about this. And like, it was a page with something about, you know, why it's sustainable to eat insects. And some vegan man responded like, or we could just eat plants. And I'm like, you know what? Like, okay, so I'm not even supposed to have this conversation about this. Like, that's defining everything by, you know, cutting out
what it's not.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I feel like that's so awful and boring, you know, and totally antithetical to what, and like, I don't usually call myself a journalist, but like, it's antithetical to what journalism is. It's like, we're supposed to have conversations.
So why are people so opposed to it? What's the...
Because they just, I mean, I guess, but this is a terrible comparison, but when people try and be compassionate toward pro-life people, and they're like, well, if you thought that like all these babies were being murdered, that sort of thing, then wouldn't you be upset about it? And it's like, and that's how vegans feel, I guess, is like, oh, all these animals are being murdered, and I have to draw really hard lines about who I even talk to or interact with or engage with, or and even ideas, I can't even engage with the idea of eating insects and what that would mean ecologically. And like, I think that's bad.
what is your ultimate stance on insects, or what was the conversation with Soleil like?
The conversation with Soleil was really cool, but I mean, it mostly focused on like what could go wrong in eating insects. Like, you know, they're a great source of protein, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the world eats insects, you know, easily without all this fraught discussion of how weird it is. And we talked about how in the US, like, there's been a lot of focus on cricket, using crickets for like protein bars and protein balls and that sort of thing.
Anything where you can't see the cricket.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like, and she was pointing out how that could create issues around like overproduction of crickets. And then you know, same thing with like bananas, you know, like where they become diseased and then all of a sudden all gone. And
all tomatoes.
Yeah, exactly. And so like that was more what that conversation was like. Yeah. I have no hard lines about anything. Like, I have no ultimate decisions about literally anything I eat.
I think insects are, it's an interesting, like, there was a lot of conversation with someone else about if they have an exoskeleton, because they're not sentient, like, you can eat them, but then fish aren't sentient. And then it goes into, like, where do you draw, is the ultimate point of veganism? We don't eat sentient things, or we're doing better for the environment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I would hope it leans more toward the latter, I think. And then, but also with, you know, compassion, I guess. But for me, it's like I have my own personal boundaries around, like, you know, I just don't want to eat animals. You know?
Yeah. Yep.
Another thing that I sort of struggle with related to this debate is how much of a personal responsibility should we be taking, and how much influence really can an individual in deciding to change what they eat? How much influence is that one person going to have? And yes, fine, there are arguments about collective action and one person leads to another person leads to another person. But to me, it seems like most of the damage is done in meat systems, in food waste, in all of these conversations. The damage is done way before the individual gets involved. It's done at the corporate level, at the manufacturing level. And me deciding not to eat meat is going to, I mean, not be zero impact, but pretty minimal.
Super minimal, yeah.
So, well, yeah, go ahead.
No, and I mean, that's why I think that veganism has to have more, it has to happen before you eat the soft serve ice cream cone and post it on Instagram. Like, it has to incorporate a lot more work that most people are not willing to do. And like, obviously, like, I'm, you know, because I'm a writer, that's part of my, like, I guess, activism in this space is that I have a platform to be like, well, we, you know, doing this helps in this way. And there are a lot of arguments for veganism just being kind of a boycott and thus grounded in consumerism anyway. Those are arguments, but at the same time, again, you know, it collectively, one would hope it has some sort of grander impact. But I think, as we're seeing, the grander impact is really just that a lot of people with money decide there's an avenue to make more money by smushing together vegetables to make meat patties.
It's that weird. It's almost like the issues with feminism where it's like it's easier to buy the shirt.
Yes.
But it's harder to go to Alabama and do something about it.
Yeah.
Or do you really want to go do that?
Think about where the shirt was made and who made it and how much the women in working in a sweatshop were paid and what rights they had and decisions about agency in terms of making decisions about their careers and things like that.
And also, I had a really weird like existential moment a few months ago in a southern city, I guess I won't name which, just to not throw anyone under the bus, at a conference where it was like all these women, we were talking about how women's suffrage really came about in these like tea rooms, and women were kind of used that as like this back channel way of getting people to be ply men to be more open to having women vote. And I looked around the room and I just thought to myself, I know most of you probably voted against your own social interests in the last election, but like at the same time, do you choose your own family wealth over it's like a really complicated it's complicated to exactly. go back up the chain.
Exactly. And that's why I've the longer I've been involved in veganism, the more I've become, you know, afraid of making any pronouncements about anything.
How did you get into vegan baking, and what was the process like to learn the particular ingredients and techniques that go along with it?
Right. Yeah. So I had been baking a lot like traditionally, and then I decided I was like, okay, I'm vegan now, so I'm just going to buy vegan baking cookbooks and use those and learn how to do it that way. And then everything like sucked. Like it really
didn't
sucked.
Taste good.
It tasted awful. So like, I hate Earth Balance a lot. There are people who
you hate what a lot?
Earth Balance, which is like it's a vegan butter replacement. Like super, it's like I think there's palm oil in it.
It's like pressed oils, just
oils smushed together. Veganism is a lot of smushing things together. So it tasted terrible. Like there was canola oil in the cake, and then like using Earth Balance to make the frosting, and just like tons of sugar and. It was all terrible. And then I was like, learned about this oil, coconut oil. Like, this is literally in, like, 2011. So, like, and I was like, oh, maybe you could use that. And I, like, did so much research and spent so much time and so much money trying to make, like, butter from coconut oil. And then I finally figured it out. And that was cool.
How do you do it? What's the secret?
Tell us.
No, so it wouldn't be, like, it wouldn't taste like butter. But it was perfect for using for, like, frosting and that sort of thing. So I would use melted coconut oil in a lot of applications, but to make cookies or to make frosting, I would blend together like 80% oil. It wasn't an exact science, but like 80% oil to 20% coconut milk, so that like kind of mimics butter's like oil to milk fat ratio.
Interesting.
And then I would like chill it and it would be solid, and I would just use it like butter. Yeah. And it actually, like, people liked it a lot, like, who didn't even like frosting usually, and I think it was because it was such like a completely bland flavor that it was based off of.
Like it would take on the flavor of
what you
put on. It
would take on exactly the flavor of just what you would put on. So like, especially if you like peanut butter, chocolate, like it would just like be so much more that flavor than it would be like the powdered sugar or whatever, because or butter.
Well, do you think that there are just certain things? So I've been also doing a lot of vegan cooking for this other show that I've been doing with Well and Good, and there are just certain things that feels like it's just hard to recreate vegan, and perhaps at some point you're adding so much weird starches or weird ramifications of palm oil or whatever to make that final product look the same as a regular macaron, perhaps. Yeah. Like, is it even worth it? It's the same for like the Impossible Burger argument. Like, what do you think about that?
Right. And I mean, you know, I struggle, like, to me, obviously, it's like, you know, eating aquafaba is not that much different from eating an egg white, like, in terms of grossness, you know? Like, I think aquafaba tastes terrible in baked good applications.
What's aquafaba for listeners who might not?
Yeah, it is the water in, like, a can of chickpeas that you can whip into, like, a meringue-like substance.
There's just, like, residual starch from the chickpeas that have soaked in it?
Yes. So people make like macarons out of that. People make meringues. They use it to make like Swiss meringue buttercream or whatever.
They make mayonnaise at Sir Kensington's with it.
Yes. So the mayonnaise application, and also there are now like vegan butters. There's this one called faba butter that they take the aquafaba from like hummus makers and then use it to make mayo or to make butter. And so like that's a like cool thing to use up something that would otherwise like go down the drain, I guess.
Yeah.
But Yeah, it is weird. Like, they're really good macarons. Vegan macarons are made by, like, this woman, this bakery, Sweet Marisa's. And she does not use aquafaba. She uses, I think she uses a modified soy protein, which also, like, molecular gastronomy type chefs would use to make, like, foams and that sort of thing.
Oh, like soy lecithin?
Not lecithin, no.
Oh, interesting.
I have a bag of it at home called VersaWhip.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that was chemically produced.
I don't know. I don't think it's GM. Like, I honestly, again, I don't know what she's using. I've only been trying to figure it out.
What does an aquafaba meringue taste like?
It tastes a little beany. It tastes a little like
it tastes like it came out of a can of chickpeas.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like, I can, when you do, like, just the meringue, like, by itself and you taste it, it tastes like cereal milk a little bit.
Like, that doesn't sound bad.
No, it's not terrible, but it's also, like, you know, you're not going to use that to make, like, something nice. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break on that note. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hotel and restaurant uniforms. Tillet is redefining workwear for the hospitality industry, ensuring that you and your team feel great from stove to street. Tillet is a full line of workwear clothing from pants to work shirts, chef aprons, jackets, dresses, chef coats, and more, with over 95% of their garments produced in the USA. Each hotel and chefwear collection is timed with the seasons, comprised of exceptional, functional fabrics and built to last. Custom uniforms can be tailored for your restaurant, hotel, or store. Learn more at tillitnyc.com. That's T-I-L-I-T-N-Y-C.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Korsha Wilson, and I'm the host of A Hungry Society here on HRN. A Hungry Society focuses on highlighting dope people doing amazing work in food, and we talk about how we can make the culinary world a more diverse and inclusive space. You can join the conversation by checking out A Hungry Society wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast. I am your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
I'm Ethan Frisch.
And today we're with Alicia Kennedy, a freelance food writer and the podcast host of Meatless.
We were just talking about vegan ingredients, aquafaba. What are some of the other kind of staple ingredients of a vegan bakery or a vegan kitchen?
I mean, for me, like, it's coconut oil, coconut milk, maybe cashew milk.
What do you use cashew milk for?
Just in cake, like, because it's cheaper than coconut milk, so.
And it tastes good.
Yeah, 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 for sure. And, you know, and flax and arrowroot. Those are the staples, I'd say. Yeah.
Do you prefer arrowroot over tapioca?
Yes.
Why?
It's less gummy. Mm-hmm. It has less flavor. It's just, yeah, I don't know.
Because I feel like, I mean, we've talked around this on a lot of issues over the last half hour, but... how much of vegan baking is trying to recreate flavors that you would get from non-vegan bacon and how much of it is trying to create new food flavors or experiences?
There is no, I don't think there's anything about creating newness at all in it.
Is there something that you would want to create? Like
recreate?
Not recreate. Just like, is there like a thing that if you could just build from scratch, not related to anything?
Oh boy. No. I mean, that's a huge question. No, I don't. There's nothing in my head that I've been like, oh, I would like, I've imagined something. I'm not that creative. So I'm like, no, there's nothing I've thought of. I'm really just like, I want a chocolate chip cookie.
What's like the most vegan dessert that you've made, or what's the vegan dessert that you feel like?
Well, carob tart is like the most vegan dessert.
I love carob. I feel like carob doesn't get the credit that it deserves. I love carob as its own flavor, not as a chocolate replacement, but I just like the tartness, the like fruity, nutty combination of flavors. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead and talk about carob.
I have a lot of carob in my house that I have to use. So I've literally been thinking like, okay, I have to make a carob tart, and I'll probably like do a piece in my column about like carob, and its significance to the vegan community with a tart recipe.
What is its significance?
Just because there used to be like no availability of vegan chocolate, so it just had to be carob. And so like when you used to, I mean, RIP Angelica Kitchen, which is like, I used to love it.
I remember that.
I know. It's not like I loved it so much. Like I was like, oh, yummy, yummy. But yeah. I was like, this is like a very satisfying like context in which to eat. And they had the carob. They had a carob tart there. That was good.
Can you tell our listeners who are not familiar, carob? Right. Yeah.
It's, you know what? You probably know better because I'm just like.
It's a pod. It grows on a tree. It's a brown, it looks like almost like a flat tamarind pod or like.
It's not related to chocolate, cacao. Right. Cacao
not
at
all. It's a traditional Middle Eastern ingredient, a sweetener, and carob powder itself is very sweet just naturally. And it has kind of a vaguely chocolatey, although I feel like that's almost more of a sort of cultural association right. That's been forced on it. It's a sort of a nutty, tart, sweet flavor, chicory almost, or like very acidic coffee, kind of that kind of profile.
Right? Ethan's the best at describing.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I have some Sunspire, the brand, sent me a lot of chocolate chips and carob, so that I have to do something with those.
I brought back a whole bunch of carob powder from Turkey at the end of last summer. Because I have this like thing, I like carob, and so I was trying to convince people to use it, and maybe we could market it as a spice. And I think the association with crunchy 1980s and 90s health food,
yes,
which is sort of how I grew up going to the health food store on the Upper West Side and getting carob covered almonds or something, because somehow that was at least perceived to be a healthier snack than a chocolate covered almond, right. Whether it is or not, I have no idea, but it must have been, there must have been stabilizers and wax and all kinds of other things in it to make it act like chocolate, because it doesn't naturally. I don't think it has anywhere near the natural fat content. Yeah.
What is it traditionally used with?
That's a really good question. I've seen it sold in markets in Turkey and Lebanon and other places in the Middle East, these like big pods. I think as a sweetener, I've heard that there's a sometimes like a masculinity thing associated with it, because the pods themselves could be seen as sort of phallic if you were looking for that.
Interesting. Okay.
But it's a great question. I don't know off the top of my head sort of traditional recipes that it's used in.
If you get that into the hands of like the right chef, we could maybe reform carob.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Done.
New marketing campaign for
plan,
carob.
Plan made. Let's do it. I was trying to get it to some people as a low glycemic or no sugar, no added sugar sweetener for a barbecue sauce. We had a conversation with a company about but I don't know. They never went anywhere. So, how did we get to carob?
You know, vegan baking.
Oh, right.
It is the most vegan thing, is like a carob, like a, you know, a tart shell filled with like some sort of carob substance.
How do you feel about carob? Do you like it? Do you?
Oh, I always liked it, but I always, as a novelty, I didn't grow up with it for sure. Like, once I decided to like get into this vegan lifestyle, I was totally on board with the idea of it. Yeah.
Can we talk about something else that I realized wasn't vegan that I was surprised about? So I was talking to, we work with a farm in Guatemala for cardamom, and I was talking to somebody else in Guatemala and working with farmers to grow the little tiny red insects that get ground up to make the, I mean, actually you're the perfect person to talk to about this. You're nodding. So yeah, tell us this story.
Well, no, like they ground up those bugs to make like Campari. Red.
They do?
Yeah. Is that how they color Campari, or is it kind of an older, more traditional?
I haven't gotten any updates on this. I'm going to assume that Campari, because of how much they're creating, is using something else to dye it red now. I know I've recently talked to a Brooklyn-based aperitivo maker, St. Agrestis. Their new Inferno bitters are red, and like they've clearly been trying to just mimic Campari, but with better ingredients. And so they are not using the bugs at all.
Do you remember what they're called? I'm trying to
remember. I don't. Is it the beetle? Because this was a whole thing too, when Starbucks had a strawberry frappuccino that was colored with the bugs.
The same bug.
The same bug. Really? Yeah, these are the bugs that make things red, but I don't know what they're called.
I don't know what they're called.
Do they have a flavor?
They don't seem to. And at least in Guatemala, they seem to grow on cactuses. So they're growing these kind of nopales, like big flat plate cactuses, and the bugs live on the plate of the cactus, and then they die. I think they die naturally, whatever their lifespan is, and they collect the little dead red bugs and grind them up, and you get a very intense, bright, kind of red-orange powder.
Yeah, someone's drinking a Negroni, like, right here.
Right on the other side of the recording studio window.
It probably has bugs in it.
I hope it has bugs.
That's so interesting.
And the other thing is the shellac beetle.
Yeah?
Which is a...
Tell me more.
An insect, like the waxy coating on apples or a lot of other...
Oh, really? They grind up beetles to make that?
I believe is made somehow... I don't know what the process is, but I believe is extracted from a shellac beetle. It's called a shellac beetle.
Interesting. I mean, when I was... Shellac. This is not from bugs, but when I was in Marrakesh recently, I was gifted some... I bought some mace and spices from a store, and they gifted me this thing that's like a naturally occurring... substance, and if you just wet it with some water, it's like red, like lipstick red, and that's what women use for their lip color, and it's a natural thing, and it looks kind of like an upside down funnel.
Yeah,
it was interesting, and it was like at every market that was like a thing there for, I guess, back when that was like the makeup norm. I'm sure they have normal makeup now, but like that was a thing,
right?
So it's so interesting.
Yeah, I'm so glad this is interesting. Actually, I've been talking to my friend Layla Schlack, who works at Wine Enthusiast, and she's constantly just being like, people don't know how many bugs they're eating all the time. And I'm like, yeah, we need to tell them.
Talk more about bugs. So, I mean, what if somebody is looking to cook more vegan food or bake more vegan baked goods, where do you recommend they start? What are some... what's a good place, either a cookbook or some other resources? Columns, obviously.
Oh, yes, my columns. Yes, I have a like huge collection of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks, but I don't cook from cookbooks like ever. So I can't like totally recommend it. I recently wrote about Roughage, which is a new cookbook by Abra Behrens, who's a chef and like former farmer in Michigan. And her cookbook is amazing. And it's like completely focused on vegetables. And I think is the best thing to learn how to cook vegetables from. In terms of vegan baking, for me, I've always been... more interested in trying, not trying to like veganize traditional recipes, but like trying to figure out how traditional recipes work so that I can make vegan stuff from those principles. So I really rarely ever follow a vegan baking recipe or a traditional baking recipe to the letter. I'm like, you know, I like to just adapt things and try.
Can we also talk a little bit about your podcast before we get into fun questions at the end? Can you tell us how you started the podcast and also how you think about the guests who come on? I mean, Ethan and I have our own weird little process of figuring out how to stage people, but how do you keep the themes recurring but interesting, and how do you, you know, space out people so that they kind of build off each other?
Right. Yeah. So the reason I started the podcast was actually that I got a press release for the Superiority Burger Cookbook. I said, you know, should I be doing a podcast? I don't know. And I sent an email back to the publicist and was like, hey, I'm launching a podcast. Would Brooks want to come on? And they said yes. And then I was like, I guess I have a podcast now. So that's how it started. And ever since, I have, you know, just I've had on a lot of like friends, but friends who do things in food. So it makes sense. And I never care about having a vegan on necessarily. I feel like the conversation's always very, very different when I do have a vegan on, and it's like we're like, you know, really, you know, getting in there with like the, you know, Carol Adams references and that sort of thing. But like, who wrote The Sexual Politics of Meat? She's very important. But yeah, so I just, you know, I have people on who are thoughtful about food. That's my only real rule. And, you know, I don't have anyone on who isn't, you know, who has never even thought about why they eat meat or eat eggs or eat dairy, or, mm-hmm. and has never like thought about the connection between like what we eat and where it comes from, that sort of thing. Like, you know, I have my friend Tia Keenan, who's a cheese writer in Queens, brilliant. I had her on and we talked about, you know, cheese and the differences between, you know, European processes and American processes. But then it also like completely got into like, you know, what is our restaurants going to dissolve if we end capitalism, that sort of, so it's like, mm-hmm. it's a very like broad spectrum and of people, from chefs and writers and activists and that sort of thing.
What is The Sexual Politics of Meat? Now I want to know.
So The Sexual Politics of Meat is a text by Carol Adams that makes connections between the ways we regard animals and the ways we regard women.
Interesting.
So basically it's an eco-feminist text about how consuming animals is a patriarchal act.
Interesting. Yeah. How do you feel about it?
Oh, I love it. I mean, theoretically, love it. I feel like there's always a more nuance than that. And she does express a lot of nuance. And she also wrote a really great book recently called Burger, about like how America's been obsessed with burgers forever and why that is. But to do it through a vegan lens, I thought was really interesting. Yeah.
Are there other books or other writers who you really admire or who you recommend people look for?
Absolutely. Yeah. Bryant Terry, of course, and Breeze Harper. Bryant Terry is more on the cookbook end. And then Breeze Harper is a black academic who works in veganism and they're all very brilliant. There's another, one of my favorite people who's vegan and cooks is Lagusta Yearwood, who has a chocolate shop called Lagusta's Luscious in New Paltz. And her cookbook's coming out in the fall, and I'm super, super excited about that. So I would say follow her on Instagram, because she does write a lot on Instagram.
And then in the last few minutes, we pivot to a lighter, not that this has been a particularly heavy conversation, but we're going to ask you some funny questions and
fun, yeah.
See what happens.
Cool.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
You use this as an example, and I was like, should
I
think about that?
We warned you this was coming.
Yeah. I know. What would it be?
And like mass, not just like be okay at it, but like be
you
the
are
best.
The best.
Oh, play guitar.
Oh, well, actually, I think we've heard that like
of
a few
course,
times. Yeah.
Yeah,
that is that would
music
be because
everyone just
up.
Wants to be a rock star. No, you
so
know.
Would you be a rock star? Is that what you would do with your newfound guitar mastery?
I guess that would be cool. Yeah.
What kind of music would you play?
I mean, I don't know, like power pop.
Yes.
Yeah.
What did you eat for lunch when you were growing up?
You know, so I've always been like a weird eater and not a weird eater. Like because I was never like really a picky eater, but I've always been a very snobby eater. And that's like now going back to everything I've said, I'm sure that makes sense. But I'm like when I was a kid, I would never eat white bread or American cheese. So
because they're gross.
They're really gross. And like I knew that like viscerally as a child. And like my mom would have to like make me like she would send me to school with like salad and chicken and like.
It's quite nice.
Yeah, no, that was nice of her. But yeah, because I would never eat the school food and I would never eat like a sandwich like a normal child. Yeah.
School food is really sad. I remember eating a lot of chicken nuggets.
Yeah.
If you could have a superpower, what would your superpower be?
You know, it's like a question that like, oh, this comes up all the time, I guess, is as a hypothetical, but I've never answering it properly. But I think, I guess... teleportation.
Oh, yes. That's mine,
you know,
too.
I think when we ask guests this question, transportation...
this is New York, yeah.
The practicality, yes. Like we all want a practical superpower to not have to sit on the subway during rush hour or whatever
yes.
it is.
Yes.
Would you use it for anything more
extravagant?
Yeah, or like poetic, or is it really just about
around? You know, no, I would go take myself like to Spain, I guess, and eat. And then come home.
Go for lunch.
Yeah, I just go to Spain for lunch. Yeah.
I feel like women will say teleportation, and then when we have men on, it's like a similar idea, but they'll be like, I want to fly. Mm.
Right.
Like more grandiose.
What do you think that says?
I think it's a, you know, I don't know what that says. What does it say, Ethan?
Men want to fly and women want to teleport?
I mean, I think it just goes back to like how things are marketed towards men and women in a certain way. It's like, right. We're trying to get things done. Men are like, look at me.
Oh, I'm Superman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe the fact that when you're flying, other people can see you flying, and when you're teleporting, they can't.
It's not like about getting to A and B. Yeah.
It's peacocking.
Right.
A little bit, yeah. A lot bit. Well, since you don't eat eggs, what is your favorite egg replacement?
All egg replacements suck. I mean, in terms of like a replacement that I could like scramble up or make into an omelet, like chickpea flour. Okay, chickpea flour.
Okay.
You can make an omelet with that, and it's fine.
Fine. Yeah. What is it? Does it? I mean, is it like something you look forward to eating in the morning,
no,
or it's
never,
like
never.
Okay?
it's too thick and spongy. Maybe someone's better at making them than I am. I don't know. But you need that Indian, the black salt that makes things taste like eggs to use it to make it taste like eggs a little bit.
Oh.
But Kala Namak.
Yeah. It has sulfur in it or something, right?
Right. Right. So it's eggy.
Oh.
Yeah. But chickpea flour, I think, does the best job.
Don't they make like tofu out of chickpea flour somewhere?
Yes, yeah, right? And Toad Style in Bed-Stuy, they make the Burmese.
Yeah. Shan tofu. That's what it's called. Yeah.
And some of the I think Tibetan food also. There's mm-hmm. a chick or a, some other bean-based tofu. Anyway, have you converted family members to veganism?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
What
I mean, to go back to no one in my family listens to me. My sister, when she was like 15, she's almost 19, she did an amazing April Fool's joke where she texted our entire family this grand paragraph that was like, Alicia, you've really changed my life and I'm going to be vegan now and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. And she's like, April Fool's. so that's how my family is about it. Yeah.
What are some of your favorite vegan restaurants or vegan dishes at non-vegan restaurants in the city?
Ooh, at non-vegan restaurants. I mean, I like to eat pizza that has no cheese on it and has like...
Roberta's has that.
I know, yeah, with olives and arugula. That's usually what I go to when I go to... we go to Barbancino in Crown Heights a lot. At non-vegan restaurants, all I eat is this. I don't know why this is difficult to answer, but...
Like highlights of the last week or so?
Well... I have a vegan paella in a bag.
Oh, yes. We were talking about that before the show. We don't know what's in it.
We don't know what's in it. I'm super excited to eat it, though, because it's from Mercado Little, speaking of Spain, Mercado Little Spain, which is at Hudson Yards, which that's a whole other topic. But
Have you been to the shawarma at Hudson Yards yet?
No. Like, is it good?
No, the giant
thing. The shawarma. There's shawarma there? No. Spanish now, yes. I've seen it, but I'm like, I didn't go in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a vegan paella in a bag that I'm excited to find out what's in it from that Jose Andres restaurant. Yeah.
Man, best book you read recently?
Oh boy, Fascination by Kevin Killian.
Ooh, that was like a you knew right away. I like that.
But also Vile Days, which is a collection of Gary Indiana's Village Voice columns from the late 80s. Both of these are from Semiotech. So I'm like, obviously I majored in English and I like reading, and like most of what I read is like weird fiction or weird memoirs and like art criticism. That's what I don't really read anything about food unless I have to for work.
Building off that, do you read the comments to any of the things you write?
Oh, absolutely not. I can't. No. I mean, you know, it's nice when people say nice things on Twitter and tag me or whatever, but I wrote something for like the Washington Post last year, which was super silly of me to do, but it was just like an opinion thing because like they'd announced that Gordon Ramsay was going to do a travel food show or whatever.
Oh, yeah. And did they ever do that?
I think it's still happening.
Okay.
But someone like made me, they were like, hey, do you want to react to this? And I was like, I've never done that before. Sure, let's react to it. And then like the comments on that apparently were a nightmare, but I didn't look at them. My friends did.
I think I read that piece actually before I knew you.
Oh, yeah. It was.
I agreed with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It would have been a much stronger piece had I not had to talk about Gordon Ramsay at all.
Sure. Like, yeah.
Do you have a couple of pieces of advice for an aspiring food writer or food journalist?
Absolutely, which definitely like find your niche. Like, don't just be. I think being a food writer, especially right now, being a generalist is a terrible, terrible idea. Like, it's all about like your very strong voice around an expertise, and then just be cool when you pitch people.
Good advice.
What does that mean
for life in general?
Just be cool. Like, you know, don't. You know, demand to know why your piece was rejected. Don't tell an editor that they made a mistake. Like, don't think people, you know, any better than your editors. Like, I mean, of course, do I think that people who've rejected my ideas are making a huge mistake? Yes, but I've never told them that. And like, that's why I can keep writing, I think.
Alicia, it's been such a pleasure having
you
on the podcast. Where can our listeners read your work and listen to your podcast?
My website is alicia-kennedy.com, and that has links to everything.
A-L-I-C-I-A.
Yes, and then Kennedy, like the president.
And where can they find you on social?
Alicia D. Kennedy on Instagram and Alicia Kennedy on Twitter.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thanks for listening again this week. Thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer, and to Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. And I don't know, anything else? You can, as always, email us yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can get in touch with me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And you can always find us on social at Why Food Podcast on Instagram and Facebook.
See you next week.
Bye. Gotta stop the wasting of my time. My love, we waste.
is my way to control, to control. Well, that's history of mine.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the food world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.